On this week's 51%, we look back on some of our favorite conversations from 2025. Dr. Heather Hirsch explains the FDA's decision to remove black box warning labels from hormonal therapies used to treat menopause. And former CIA officer Christina Hillsburg makes the case for why women make better spies.
Women are able to leverage the fact that we are underestimated and we can be unnoticed.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. 2025 is almost behind us. Today, we're looking back on some of our favorite conversations over the course of the year. We've covered the 25th anniversary of the FDA's approval of mifepristone, the history of the Girl Scouts, and the concept of invisible cognitive labor. Last month, we spoke with Dr. Heather Hirsch about perimenopause and the FDA's decision to remove black box warning labels from the hormonal therapies used to treat menopause symptoms. The FDA has had such warnings on hormonal therapies since the early 2000s, after a study called the Women's Health Initiative found they could contribute to an increased risk of breast cancer, heart attacks, and strokes. For years, though, doctors have been poking holes in this study and arguing that hormonal therapy improves the health and quality of life of menopausal women. Dr. Hirsch is one of them. Earlier this year, she spoke on a panel urging the FDA to ditch its warnings. While she acknowledged hormone therapy isn't for everyone, she says she wants patients to make their decisions based on fact, not fear.
So in July of this year, I was invited to be on a expert panel. And the point of the expert panel was to help the FDA commissioner, Dr. Marty McCarry, really gather more information to go back to the FDA. And we brought up two big points here. And the first is that when it came to menopausal hormone therapy, the reason that these black box warnings were outdated was those warnings didn't apply to women who started within 10 years of menopause. So the timing at which you started hormone therapy really mattered. Now, we hope that the majority of women start hormone therapy within 10 years, because that's actually typically when they have the most symptoms. And that number two, the formulation of hormones that you used also really mattered. And this, for example, depends on what type of progesterone or estrogen you use. These are blanket words, but there are synthetic progestins, and then there's progesterone, or what we call a more natural or bioidentical form of progesterone. And those two things, the time at which a woman would start hormone therapy and the formulation of hormone therapy that she would use, actually, if you did those things and you used more modern approaches, started within 10 years and used different formulations, not only were those risks not adequate, but really women mostly get benefits. So we really wanted to argue that these black box warnings were too broadly spread on menopausal hormone therapy. So that was really, really important. The second was for systemic hormone therapy. When we look at vaginal estrogen, which is actually placed locally and does not travel through the whole body, these box label warnings also did not scientifically make any sense, because they don't increase the risk of breast cancer, heart attacks, strokes, or probable dementia, because they don't travel systemically. So we wanted to argue for the removal on both. And then after that panel, we didn't hear terribly much until early in November. And I got word that I was invited to head back to the FDA to do a separate podcast with Dr. Marty McCarry on this topic. And then, of course, we had the box label removal on both systemic and vaginal estrogen in early November. But why this is so important is because there are so many myths and misconceptions about menopausal hormone therapy. And the box label warning that was placed on these medications is the highest safety warning that the government could put on a medication. And it simply really didn't apply for those reasons already stated. And it was also a huge barrier for some women to start or even be prescribed hormone therapy on the prescriber's side. So the removal of the box label warning was a really big signal. And actually, just to clarify, what the government actually decided to do was say, we no longer require this box label warning on menopausal hormone therapy, and we're going to bring this back to the pharmacies to each decide where they want to put risks of their medications in their inserts. And so I think, too, this was much more of a responsible way to do it.
You've covered this a little bit, but I want to talk a little bit more about how we got here. So I guess, you know, why were these black box warnings put on hormone therapy in the first place?
So in the 90s and even in the late 80s, most women were given menopausal hormone therapy, typically an estrogen, and then plus a progesterone if you had your uterus. And around the time of menopause, and found that they were living longer, had less heart disease and better bone health. So the thought was, well, it's obvious that estrogen is helpful. And then they decided to do the gold standard of trials, which is a randomized blinded study. That means that women were randomized and even either given hormone therapy or placebo. Now, when they did that, what's really important to know is that they got women who are on average 12 or 13 years out of menopause. But at the time, they didn't know that the timing was really crucial. Turns out that women in their early 50s are very busy and they didn't have time to get all their blood drawn and do all their testing. And so they actually got an older cohort of women. In fact, the women were aged 50 to 79. So that was one big thing. And they used one formulation in the Women's Health Initiative, Premarin or conjugated equine estrogen only if you didn't have a uterus, and then PremPro or conjugated equine estrogen with a synthetic progestin, medjoxyprogesterone acetate. And those formulations are also important. So those would be the two things I keep coming back to. So after the study went for 5 years, they found there was a slight increased risk of breast cancer in the women in the PremPro arm. But the media reported this as a relative risk of a 26% increased risk of breast cancer. If you were a laywoman reading that, you would think that means one in four women were getting breast cancer. But the absolute risk was 2 to 4 women out of 1,000 women over 5 years on that one combination of oral PremPro at that dose. But the damage was done, and this box label warning was slapped on all of menopausal hormone therapy, saying that it increased the risk of breast cancer. Now, the box label warning also said it could increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, stroke, and dementia. And at the time when this media report came out, they also noted that there was some increased risks of cardiovascular disease and stroke, but they were mostly seeing this in the older women. But it wasn't until years later that they realized that the timing is very important. So those box labels were slapped on all of hormone therapy. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, the women in the estrogen-only arm who were taking conjugated equine estrogen only and not the synthetic progestin, who didn't have a uterus, that's why they could take estrogen only, they were having actually reductions in breast cancer compared to the women in the placebo. So that is actually really, really interesting. And that's kind of where this warning came. And it was really slapped across all formulations of hormone therapy. Now, when scientists sat back and thought, the women in the conjugated equine estrogen only arm were doing really well, maybe it wasn't the estrogen that was the problem. Maybe it was the synthetic progestin. And when they do different studies using micronized natural progesterone or Prometrium, a more naturally based progesterone, they don't see any increased risk of breast cancer above baseline. And women who start within 10 years, studies show actually can have reductions in cardiovascular disease, reductions in death from all causes, reductions in heart attacks, and improvement in bones, as well as reduction in diabetes. So those two things are really, really important. And that's kind of where all of this fear really stemmed from in the early 2000s.
You say the timing you start hormone therapy is important within 10 years of menopause. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding properly. So do you mean like within 10 years after menopause or before? I guess technically, I guess when you're in perimenopause.
So great question. Let's clarify too, like these definitions, because, you know, we use these and even I will, you know, kind of interchangeably. Menopause technically is one day of a woman's life. It's when she's had 365 days or 1 year of no periods or bleeding. And that day she can say, this is menopause. And every day after that is postmenopause. So the idea of hormone therapy actually is after menopause, we want to start you on your hormone therapy, ideally within 10 years from your last period. Now, perimenopause is all the time leading up to that, where a woman might start to experience symptoms or change in periods. And so perimenopause is also a crazy time can also last a good, 5 to 7 or 10 years. Now, you can start menopausal hormone therapy in perimenopause, and I talk a lot about that in my new book, The Perimenopause Survival Guide. But when it comes to the best time to start hormone therapy to get the benefits, it's definitely anytime before that 10-year mark of your last period.
Dr. Heather Hirsch is a board-certified internist and founder of the Menopause Clinic at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. She has a new book out called The Perimenopause Survival Guide. You can learn more about her work at heatherhirschmd.com, and you can hear our conversation in full at wamcpodcast.org. 2025 was a financially challenging year for Planned Parenthood. In addition to losing Title X funding, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act passed by Congress and signed by President Trump over the summer effectively blocked Planned Parenthood clinics from receiving Medicaid funding. The law technically denies funding for abortion providers and affiliated clinics that received more than $800,000 in Medicaid funding in 2023. But Planned Parenthood is the main provider that falls under that criteria. Now, to be clear, the federal government already does not provide funding for abortions, but Planned Parenthood clinics rely on the Medicaid funding they receive from other services, like birth control, cancer screenings, and STI testing. Planned Parenthood President and CEO Alexis McGill Johnson warned earlier this year that the move could cause many clinics to close. We spoke with Johnson shortly before the Big Beautiful Bill was signed into law.
It would mean that nearly 200 Planned Parenthood health centers in about 24 states would be at risk of closure, and more than 90% of those health centers, those closures, would be in states where abortion is actually protected and legal. So in many ways, not only would the impact of this bill passing mean that, so many patients would be limited in their access to birth control, to STI testing and treatment, to breast cancer screenings and wellness exams, it would also mean that in those states where abortion is legal, that there would be fewer appointments available, there would be fewer providers available, and that would impact, again, the ongoing public health crisis as it relates to the world post-Dobbs.
You mentioned, I think you said 24 states, and not all of them currently restrict abortion. Tell me more about the locations here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you look at how the states that have been able to take advantage of Medicaid as as a broad insurer in their communities, many of those states are states that have expanded access to healthcare under the Affordable Care Act. There are many of the states that really prioritize ensuring that their constituents have a broad, wide-ranging access to care across the board. So that's going to be, states like California and New York and Illinois and Michigan. And while there is Medicaid access all across the country in many states, it does feel that in particular, the way this provision is designed is to really go after the Planned Parenthoods that are in states with abortion access.
Well, obviously, as you noted, Planned Parenthood does more than just abortions. How would these closures impact your patients?
Well, look, I mean, we're already in a precarious time, right? Healthcare in general is in a precarious time. We have been at minimum since COVID, and then you layer on the Dobbs decision, and then you layer on these attacks on Medicaid defunding. And, we have obviously a lot of services that Planned Parenthood provides. When you start to take away health centers and the provision of care, it means that people may delay their care longer or seeking access to care until they can travel longer distances in order to get that. It may mean that forgo all care altogether, right? And so, we have like a state like Georgia, for example, which has, about only half of the counties in Georgia have an OBGYN. And Planned Parenthood sits kind of at the intersection of being able to fill the gaps inside of a broken healthcare system. and you start to chip away at access and their ability to use their insurance to pay for that care. And you will see, increases in things like the maternal mortality rate. You will see increases in STI rates. You will see increases in HIV rates because people are going to delay or be prevented from getting the care that they need.
From your view, has, I guess, the country's abortion debate or the landscape around it changed in the months since President Trump returned to office?
Yeah, I don't know that the debate has changed. I think that the consolidation of power has changed. Abortion has actually been quite a uniting factor among the majority of Americans, as we have seen in ballot initiative after ballot initiative. When people are allowed to vote directly on whether or not they want to preserve or even expand abortion access, they overwhelmingly vote in support. What has changed over the years has been a capture and consolidation of power of state houses and judges by anti-abortion politicians and jurists. And in that regard, again, it requires the people to stay vigilant to ensure that they are voting and holding these electeds accountable for the decisions that they are making that are completely counter to where the people sit. I see an expansion of abortion public opinion in many ways. I see a broader understanding of how abortion bans have made pregnancy more dangerous and a greater understanding of the abortion care that is needed in miscarriage management. And I think people are connecting the dots on the fact that we are at much greater risk with fewer rights, and that we need our elected officials to stand a lot stronger in defending our rights and freedoms.
Alexis McGill-Johnson is the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood. Since our conversation, Planned Parenthood has sued to strike down the provision. U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani of Massachusetts issued a preliminary injunction temporarily blocking it. But most recently, as of this taping anyway, a First Circuit panel rejected that order. In a separate lawsuit, 22 states and Washington, D.C. also challenged the provision. Judge Talwani recently issued another preliminary injunction blocking the provision from being carried out in those states, and as of this taping, that is still live. A report last month from Planned Parenthood found 20 of its clinics have closed so far since the signing of the Big Beautiful Bill. We spoke to our last guest in July around the release of her book, Agents of Change, The Women Who Transformed the CIA. Christina Hillsburg is herself a former intelligence officer for the CIA, where she specialized in African politics. The CIA says women now make up about half of the agency, but it took a long time to get there. And Hillsburg's own career made her want to recognize the women who came before her. Agents of Change tracks the history of women in the agency and challenges the sexy femme fatale stereotype you often see in pop culture. Hillsburg argues women actually make some of the best spies, precisely because they are often underestimated.
It was fantastic to interview women across generations. There is something really special about talking with a woman in her 80s about her experience at the CIA in the 60s and 70s. And, feeling that bond and those parallels, for better or worse, with my experience some decades later. So when I started in 1960, I introduced the reader to three primary women. There's Lucy, who was a Wellesley graduate with, graduated with the world seemingly at her feet, wanted an international career, thought she'd join the Peace Corps, very similar to my own story. And coincidentally fell into a CIA career just as I did. And so I trace her story going into China ops, doing covert influence campaigns. And then I also talk about a woman named Jeanine Bruckner, who became very important to the women's movement within the CIA and was responsible for a watershed moment when she actually sued the agency after she was wrongfully accused of sexual harassment later in the 90s. So we follow her upward trajectory and then unexpected downfall in the way she turned that around in her life. And really, really fascinating story. And then the third woman that we start with is a woman named Marti Peterson, who was the first woman to operate clandestinely in Moscow in the 70s. And she actually began as what they called a CIA wife. She was a contractor. Her husband was stationed in Laos, and she did things like file and type and wrap the pouch to send information back to headquarters. But Marti was actually highly overqualified for such things. And after her husband unfortunately was shot down in a helicopter and she became a widow, she then entered the CIA in her own right and became a case officer and, went to Moscow. And I go into all of those thrilling details and why she was able to be so successful as a woman there and how that actually was one of the reasons why, the primary reason why she was able to conduct dead drops, because it never dawned on the KGB that we would be using a woman for such things. And so she was able to go virtually unnoticed, conducting these operations.
When you say a dead drop, what is a dead drop?
So, a dead drop is when you or your asset are leaving information for the other person. You drop it's usually, disguised as something someone wouldn't want to pick up, as garbage, trash, a log, and then the asset will then come later and pick up the package when you're not there. And that's also a way that an asset can deliver intelligence that they've collected for their CIA handler.
And you say in your book that women, because of their experiences and because, like you said, like so many people weren't expecting a woman to be doing these things, that this makes them actually like very well equipped to be spies.
That's so true. I think women are able to leverage the fact that we are underestimated and we can be unnoticed. The CIA operates in environments all over the world with different cultural views. And so if it is a particular culture that doesn't value women, women can be in the background and, stealing secrets right under the noses of foreign governments, which is exactly what we want to do, right? We don't want to cause a big car chase scene like James Bond. We want to be doing things without them realizing it. And so women are able to use that to their advantage. Additionally, there were things that came up multiple times during my interviews. And I interviewed dozens of women. In addition to the three I mentioned, we go into the next generation of women and you meet some more. But the theme that kept coming up is that women felt that we bring qualities and traits to the table that make us advantageous spies. Now, you could argue that some of them sound like generalizations, but when they come up so many times anecdotally, it's hard to ignore. So, for instance, women often said, we're better listeners for our assets, we're nurturing, we are more detail-oriented, we notice things that our male colleagues wouldn't notice, like a surveillance socks or shoes. Oftentimes, assets can feel more comfortable with a woman handler because they don't feel the pressure to impress their male handler and, outdo them. And so they can feel more comfortable sharing. At the same time, women work things to their advantage, like, oh, silly me, I'm just a silly woman who doesn't know anything. And then they end up getting all this information, right? So we play on those stereotypes. At the same time, it also brings its challenges, right? Women have to be very clear about boundaries, that this is a professional relationship. And so women told me all the different ways that they would ensure that was clear. And it was everything from I dressed as unattractive as possible to I made sure the bed was never in line of sight if we were in a hotel meeting, which is very common. So that's something women have to think about as well.
As you're interviewing these women across different generations, are there ways in which you've seen the environment for women in the CIA change, or has it really not changed a whole lot since then?
There were some days after my interviews where I felt the progress very strongly. There were other days when I felt like, wow, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So I would say the answer to that is it's very nuanced, but there has been progress. And this book really is meant to be a celebration of that progress. So we are at a point now where women make up around 50% of the organization, which is fantastic. We had our first female CIA director in 2018, Dina Haspel. And then we also had our first woman director of operations, which is arguably an even bigger deal when it comes to clandestine operations, because that person, Elizabeth Kimber, is in charge of all clandestine operations worldwide. So, very huge milestone. But we do still see a drop-off of women at those higher levels. And so, that is an ongoing process of improvement. A really crucial theme to this book is this idea of holding our institutions accountable. And with the ushering of this new decade, we were also seeing a reckoning of sorts. And that is this younger generation that isn't afraid to speak up and feels energized, and they're not going to turn a blind eye to things that for so long women at the CIA felt would be career suicide if they spoke up. So that actually really came to a head, and we have seen some concrete progress on that. Congress passed the Intelligence Authorization Act, which calls for a mechanism, a reporting mechanism for CIA to actually report sexual harassment and assault to Congress. There's congressional oversight, and I think that that's very important because when you look at an environment that is male dominated, but then you also add the layer of secrecy, and that makes it very complex because for years, women were discouraged from going to law enforcement because they had to deal with this idea of being undercover. And if you go to law enforcement, you're going to jeopardize your cover and your career here. You will jeopardize your colleague's cover who you're accusing. And, it's a federal crime to release an agency officer's name, who's undercover. And so a lot of intimidation. So having those women come up and speak up rather and go to Congress and establish this is very important. So that is a big step towards progress as well.
I guess I'm wondering, do you share any of your own experiences in the book? What would you say the job is like? Because I feel like for most of us, it sounds very Hollywood.
Yes, there are so many things that we see on TV that give us the wrong idea about espionage. The number one being that people often think that women are exchanging sex for foreign intelligence, which is 100% not the case. And so one of the reasons why I, wanted to structure the book in the way that I did was to use those cultural touchstones that we know so well. And so I actually go through the decades, and each one I start with our conceptions of the female spy, what was going on with the Bond girl at that time, before I get into what was going on at the CIA, because I really wanted to write a book that appealed to readers beyond history buffs and spy aficionados, people who wanted to read about interesting women doing extraordinary things that is nothing like what they've seen in the movies, is so much more impressive. But at the end of the day, these are women who we can relate to because so much of their stories resonate with all of us, whether we have experience in espionage or not. And you get a little taste of my experience as I am your narrator throughout the book. But by and large, my goal was to amplify the voices of these incredible women who blaze the trail for me and so many others. And what I hope this book shows more than anything is that women are vital to national security.
Christina Hillsburg is a former intelligence officer for the CIA and the author of Agents of Change, The Women Who Transformed the CIA. You can learn more about her work at ChristinaHillsburg.com. We've been looking back on some of our favorite interviews from 2025. You can hear our conversation in full at WAMCpodcast.org. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at WAMC.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Have a wonderful holiday and a happy new year. I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. Taking me, where are you taking me? Sitting.